A very blessed Feast of All Saints to you and yours. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and this is Catholic Answers Live. Delighted to be with you on this feast day. And what we're going to do is a little bit of internet open forum this hour. We get a lot of questions submitted via the various internet outlets. And this hour, we gathered some of those up. Actually, Jimmy Akin gathered some of them up, and I will present them to him. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of many things, including the forthcoming book, Teaching with Authority.
Later this month.
All right. Yeah. Congratulations, Jimmy. Hi, Jimmy. How are you?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. And I like Internet Open Forum.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I always feel like we maybe give a little bit short shrift to the Internet side of it here on Catholic Answers Live. So it's good to spend an hour just digging in.
Also, I like people ask their questions very concisely on the Internet. They don't give you their life story first.
Does that happen, Jimmy Akin? I can't recall a time.
I think it's happened once or twice on the show. Someone has given us lots of information.
Extraneous
information. We actually need to answer the question.
To me, it seems, and this may just be an impression. This may not be. It seems that if I say to the caller, I'm going to need your question real quickly because we're coming up to the top of the hour or something.
Right.
That will be the very person who will go, okay, I'll get right to my question. When I was four.
Yeah. I have known it done.
Yeah, right.
To quote Pooh Bah from the Mikado.
Oh, I got to see the Mikado.
You do. I should show it to you. Yeah. It's an awesome opera.
Yeah. That's Gilbert and Sullivan, right?
Yeah, comic opera.
Yep. Who's better, Gilbert or Sullivan?
Well, I would have to say Gilbert is better.
Really?
Now, they're doing different things. So Gilbert is the librettist, so he's writing the words. Sullivan is the composer, so he's writing the music. And they're both really good at what they do.
Yeah.
I'm floored by Gilbert's use of wordplay.
It is amazing.
It is astonishing. Yeah. Sullivan, I think, is awesome, too, as a composer. But I do know other really good composers, and it's really hard to find as clever a librettist with that clever wordplay as Gilbert. Uh-huh. Also, I kind of got to give if it's a race between the two of them, I kind of got to give it to Gilbert because he died trying to save someone's life.
Did he really?
He did. He saw a drowning person and went to save him, even though he was an elderly man. And so he gave his life for another.
What a story.
Yeah.
Wow.
You could even write an opera about it.
Has anyone?
Not that I'm aware of.
I could. I maybe could be a librettist. But that would make a good opera. Do it in a Gilbert and Sullivan style.
Yeah, except comic operas don't end with the main character dying at the end.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's true.
Tragic operas do.
Yeah. But you could make it kind of a tragic comedy.
No, you could have the
comic elements.
Final scene in the afterlife where
he
learns all the things in his life that were like a big heavenly joke on him.
Yeah. And isn't there a tradition about the angels singing you home when you go? They could be singing his songs. Like,
mm-hmm.
You see,
sure.
Welcoming him to heaven. All right, Jimmy, we got a lot of internet-based questions for you. I assume you are prepared.
I am prepared. To quote SpongeBob SquarePants, I'm ready.
I'm glad we quoted SpongeBob SquarePants.
And Gilbert and Sullivan.
I know. That's a big day when you get to who's all right? Who's better, SpongeBob? No, that's not it. That's not good. Isabella from New York. Is a practicing Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So she says, my non-practicing Catholic daughter and Baptist son-in-law have told me that if I want to, we can take their son or her son, our grandson, to be baptized. I would love to have him baptized. He's now 4 years old. Yet in my Texas parish, the person who oversees sacraments says we can't baptize him because the parents will not be taking him to church. The parents are open to baptizing him, and it's true that they probably won't be taking him to Mass unless I visit or they visit me. I would love to hear the response to this.
So this represents a real pastoral situation that crops up a lot. And here in America, parishes tend to look at a particular requirement of the Code of Canon Law more stringently than in other parts of the world.
Oh.
What the Code of Canon Law provides is that in order for a child to be To be baptized, you have to have the consent of one of the parents or people who take the place of the parents, like guardians. And there has to be a founded hope that the child be raised Catholic. Now, what does that mean to raise a child Catholic? That's something the law presently doesn't clearly spell out. Mm-hmm. And so here in America, you have a lot of parishes that say, oh, it means you got to take them to Mass every week. And you know, and that's not the way it's approached in other countries.
Yeah.
In other countries, they're much more relaxed. As long as the child is raised with some awareness that, you know, you are a Catholic, and so you
yeah.
need to do what you know you need to do as a Catholic. But that they're not expecting people to be vigorously observant in order for this to be mm-hmm. for this canon to be fulfilled. So we have kind of a mismatch between the United States' approach to this and other countries' approach. I mean, to give you an example, if you look in the in the document put out by the Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants, they have a document on gypsies. And, you know, so these people move around. They don't go to Mass every week.
Yeah.
They may not show up again to get confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, the document provides for gypsy children being baptized and talks about here's what you want to do. Here are the things you want to encourage when you're baptizing a gypsy baby. And there's an understanding, okay, this child is going to be raised as a Catholic, as a gypsy, even though they may not be brought back for confirmation and even though they're almost certainly not going to be going to Mass every week,
yeah.
they still have enough of a Catholic identity established to allow them to be baptized. And so that's the approach taken in a lot of places. Here in America, we're out of sync with
okay.
that approach. And there's even been some criticism by Pope Francis and other figures that places in the world that are doing it like us are doing it more strictly than the law requires. So what I would say, since we're in America, I mean, there are a couple of options. One, since you're in Texas, go down to Mexico and have the baptism there. there are families that do things like that.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, what would potentially be even better is talk to your daughter who's non-practicing and say, you know, religion is a really important part of life. And once your child, my grandson, is baptized, he's going to need an example set for him. So maybe we can look at this as an occasion to come back to the church and to reengage with our faith. And you could even talk to the Baptist son-in-law who's willing to let the child be baptized as a Catholic. That's a sign of some openness on his part.
Right.
You could say, you know, look, if your son's going to be a Catholic, then you should, you know, learn something about the Catholic faith. Maybe even consider becoming a Catholic. It is the oldest church. It's the one that goes all the way back to Jesus. And, you know, we have these helpful resources like Why Be Catholic or Surprised by Truth or things like that that might help you learn a
yeah.
little bit more about the basis of Catholicism.
Yeah. You know, just as a common sense kind of reading, it sounds like we're more beyond a reasonable doubt here, like founded hope. I would think there's a good founded hope if the grandparents are Catholic, if there's this openness in the family,
yeah.
this child might well receive a Catholic.
Right.
You don't know for sure.
Founded hope is a really modest level of
yeah.
Of confidence. It just means some kind of evidence
yeah.
that the child is going to be raised Catholic. And raised Catholic does not mean raised to be a devout, pious, perfect Catholic with a full-orbed, you know, Catholic education and catechesis
yeah.
and all that. It just means basic Catholic identity.
Isabella, thank you very, very much for that question. It's an internet open forum today. All these questions today have come to us through the internet by various outlets there. We go now to Sean's question. Jimmy, do we have the actual, quote, autograph of any of the sacred scriptures, including the epistles?
So the autographs are the original copies of the scriptures. So like when the Gospel of John was first released to the public, the original copies, and there's probably more than one, but the original copies that a scribe made for John, and then they were given to various churches or individuals, those are called the autographs. in English today, autograph means like a signature of a famous person or something.
Yeah.
But that's not what we're talking about. It means the original copies that were released to the public, not counting drafts that were prepared ahead of time pre-release. Those are drafts. They're not the autographs. As far as we know, we don't have the autographs of any of the New Testament documents. However, there have been some fascinating studies done of just how long the autographs were around and how close our earliest copies are to them. We have copies of the New Testament books that go back to the 2nd and 3rd centuries.
Okay.
And there's a fascinating book about these by a scholar named Larry Hurtado, H-U-R-T-A-D-O. It's called The Earliest Christian Artifacts. It's a short book. It's a fascinating read. And in the back of it, he has a table of the earliest Christian artifacts, the different manuscripts we have and so forth, and when they're dated to. He also – there's been some updates to this table just recently because some new manuscripts have just been published. Including one that was a first billed as a first century fragment from Mark,
mm-hmm.
although it turns out it looks like, no, it's a second or third century, but it's still really early. And if you want to see his updated table, you can go to his blog, which is larryhurtado.wordpress.com. And if you look at October 15th, 2018, a week ago, he published an updated table of the earliest manuscripts we have. And so we have manuscripts that date to the second or third centuries. The question is, how long did the autographs survive? And in the past, people would think, oh, well, maybe they survived 10 or 20 years or something like that, and then they disintegrated. No, there have been some studies made of ancient libraries that
okay.
have been published in recent years. And it turns out that in an ancient library, a book would typically survive for like 125 to 250 years. Some survived as long as 500 years, though that's exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also borne out by what we find at the Dead Sea Scrolls, because the Dead Sea Scroll community was, you know, wiped out in AD 70. And they had scrolls there that went back 200 to 300 years.
Okay.
So it was not at all uncommon to have a book last for 200 or 300 years. And so if you have the documents of the New Testament being written in the first century, you could expect them to survive into the second and third centuries, maybe even the fourth. And thus they would still be around for comparison when copies were being made, like the second and third century copies we have. And in fact, we have references in the Church Fathers to the autographs surviving in their day. There is a reference that Tertullian, the North African Christian writer, made around the year 180, talking about how he was complaining about people who were mutilating Paul's epistles, producing doctored versions. And he said, you can, if you want to know what they really said, go look at the autographs. They're in all the cities. They're like housed in Hierapolis in Turkey, modern Turkey. And so he's writing in the late second century around 180. And he's saying the autographs are still there. We even have a reference from Pope Peter I of Alexandria, who died in around the year 311. So he's writing around the year 300. And he says that the gospel, the autograph of the Gospel of John is still preserved at Ephesus, where the faithful will still venerate it.
Wow.
And so it looks like the autographs of the New Testament, in like with other ancient libraries and like with the Dead Sea Scrolls, didn't just vanish after 10 or 20 years of use. They likely survived for between 1 and 3 centuries afterwards, and people knew about them and venerated them and consulted them for settling textual questions.
Sean, I'm so grateful for that question. That's fascinating stuff right there. Before we go to break, I want to invite you to come with us on our great big giant cruise that we're taking February 10th through 17th aboard Holland America's MS New Stottendam. We're going to go to Fort Lauderdale, Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas, Ocho Rios, Jamaica, Georgetown, Grand Cayman Island, Cozumel, Mexico. And the thing is, You'll be with just dozens and dozens of other Catholics who are concerned about the state of the church, who are concerned about the state of evangelization, the state of apologetics in the world. And we'll be doing all kinds of stuff related to sharing the faith, explaining and defending the faith. Chris Check will be there, our president. Tim Staples, you probably heard of him. He'll be there. Carlo Broussard. Father Chrysostom Baer, they'll all be giving wonderful talks, at least if the usual standard is to be expected. I'll be there primarily to carry bags, but maybe they'll have one or two other things for me to do. Right now, if you actually, I think it's tomorrow. If you sign up by tomorrow, we've come to the end of it. If you sign up by tomorrow, you get an additional $125 off per person. You just go to CatholicAnswersCruise.com to sign up. We'd really love it if you'd come with us. CatholicAnswersCruise.com.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to wreck?
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are
committed. As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A very blessed All Saints Day to you and yours. Jimmy Akin is in studio with me. I am Cy Keller, your host, and Internet Open Forum means taking any question that we're taking a whole bunch of questions that we get from the Internet about all kinds of aspects of the Catholic faith. Timothy Jimmy asks, can I belong to two parishes at the same time?
The answer seems to be no, at least the way things work in the Latin Church. Even though here in America it's common to register at parishes, that doesn't technically make you a member of the parish. Your parish membership for most parishes is territorially determined. So the bishop establishes the borders of the parish, and if you live in those borders, that's your parish, whether you go to it or not. Now, there's no obligation for you to go to it. You can go to another parish. You can support another parish. There's no obligations in regard to you must do, you know, weekly mass there or anything like that, or you must donate your money there. Canon law does not establish those obligations. It does establish certain ones. Like if you want to get married, then you need to either get married in your territorial parish or you need to get permission from your territorial pastor to be married elsewhere. And oftentimes this is just taken care of by priests behind the scenes. So let's say you go to a parish that you're not a member of and you go to the pastor of the parish you normally attend and say, hey, I want to get married. He's likely to go call the priest of your territorial parish and say, hey, guy who comes to my parish wants to get married. Is it okay if I do it?
Oh, I see. And so you may never even
be aware of it.
Yeah.
But formally speaking, in the Latin Rite, your parish membership is going to be assigned on a territorial basis, not on a registration basis. Registration is just a thing that parishes here in America do for convenience, so that they have a way of contacting people and things like that. What's an interesting question is, suppose you have two residences and they're in different parishes territorially, maybe even different dioceses, and you spend approximately half your time at each domicile.
Yeah.
What happens in that case? And as far as I'm aware, there's a lacuna in the law there that's not specified. And ultimately, if you, like, say, wanted to get married – some determination would have to be made, possibly behind the scenes by the pastors, as far as which parish you're going to be considered a member of.
We might have a good number of those here in California because, as you may know, there in California, the taxes are very high. Mm-hmm. So there are many high-income people who will live in another state 6 months and one day out of the year.
Well, if it's 6 months and one day, then that may be their parish because it's more than half the time.
All right, Timothy, thank you very much for this question. Leslie says, Jimmy, when we speak of sacred tradition to someone unfamiliar with the idea, what would be the easiest and best way to explain it?
I would start with the meaning of the word tradition. It's based, and you don't really have to go into the Latin, but it's based on a word that means that which is handed down. So anything that's handed down from one person to another or from one generation to another is a tradition. And in the case of the church, many things have been handed down to us from Christ and the apostles. And in the broad sense, all of those things are sacred tradition. Some of those traditions are in written form and in the New Testament and in the Old Testament, which were also handed down to us as Scripture by Jesus and the apostles. So if you think about it this way, sacred Scripture is really a subset of sacred tradition being everything that's handed down for our faith from Christ and the apostles. And that's kind of the basic way I would present the concept to someone who's not familiar with it.
All right. Leslie, thank you for that one. Up next in our Internet Open Forum is Alex. And Alex asks, how should we interpret books such as the Book of Enoch or the Life of Adam and Eve, Apocalypse of Moses? Is there any truth to be had from these books, or are they to be treated as reading a piece of fiction?
So these books are ones that did not make it into the canon of the Catholic Church, the biblical canon. And we have to put them on slightly different footings, the two that got mentioned. The first one was the Book of Enoch. And this is a book, we know it existed before the time of Christ. There are copies of it, for example, that have fragments in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So it's a pre-Christian Jewish work, and it does influence some of the thought of the New Testament. It's even quoted by the Book of Jude. And it is even considered canonical by certain Christians in Ethiopia. But at a minimum, it was very influential on Judeo-Christian thought and even on some of the New Testament's thought. And so I wouldn't say it should be treated strictly as a piece of fiction. I would say the Catholic Church has not recognized it as canonical. We need to recognize that it has a lot of material in it that should not be taken as strictly literally historical. I mean, a good chunk of the book presents itself as having been written by the biblical patriarch Enoch,
mm-hmm.
and it almost certainly was not in any literal sense
written by
him. So it's not a work of a historical nature, but it is a work that has some influence on Jewish, Christian, and including New Testament thought. And so there are elements of truth to be mined out of it, but we have to be very careful in doing that. The other book, known as The Life of Adam and Eve, or in another edition, it's known as The Apocalypse of Moses, this work is not as clearly pre-Christian, and it is obviously plugged into the broader Judeo-Christian tradition. And it can shed light on what Jews and Christians in certain periods thought, but it has even less of a canonical connection than First Enoch does. And so I wouldn't rule out that there are things that can be learned from it that could inform our understanding, say, of different Bible passages. But we have to be really careful in doing that because it's not sacred scripture, and it's going to tell us really more about the people who wrote it and used it than it is going to tell us anything about how to understand Genesis.
But there is a greater and greater movement, it seems to me, in recent decades, maybe quite a few decades, to try to understand, for example, the Jewish mindset at the time of Jesus, or to get an
right.
And for example, when you read these books, will they help you just know what's in the air?
They will, but you got to be careful. So, like with First Enoch, that's why I distinguish these two based on date.
Yeah,
First Enoch is older than the Christian movement. Therefore, its ideas were already in circulation.
I see. Yeah.
Whereas the Life of Adam and Eve. The earliest it looks like it was written was maybe the first century. And so it's not as clear that it would predate the Christian movement, and therefore it's not as clear that it could have influenced Christian thought at that early stage, but it may have influenced some Jewish thought in the first century.
All right. Fair enough. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Internet Open Forum this hour. Next hour, our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, is going to come in. We are going to talk about All Saints, All Souls.
You're going to get to all of them? Awesome.
We're going to talk about all the saints.
Next hour, folks, all the saints and all the souls.
All the souls is going to be really hard. That's a lot. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Many atheists assert the only real form of knowledge is scientific knowledge, thus excluding any sort of religious knowledge, whether philosophical or theological. Such a belief is called scientism, and it's unreasonable for two reasons. First, it's self-refuting. Its truth cannot be verified by the scientific method. It's a metaphysical proposition, and as such, is not scientific knowledge. But if science can't verify the truth of scientism, well then, scientism itself cannot be a legitimate form of knowledge, in which case, it's self-refuting. Moreover, scientism undermines science as a rational form of inquiry because it denies presupposed philosophical assumptions that are necessary to even do science, such as there's an external world outside the minds of scientists. So, to reject God's existence on the grounds that it's not scientific knowledge is simply unreasonable. I'm Carlo Broussard with The Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders. If you just don't understand something about the Catholic faith, Call to Communion is the show for you. Join us Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to this All Saints Day edition of Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, joined in studio by Catholic Answers senior apologist Jimmy Akin. Jimmy's the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. And his newest book will be out this month, Teaching with Authority. That is a book for the person who asks, well, how much weight do I have to give that? And has the church—
Like about church teaching.
Church teaching, yeah. Or is that really church teaching, or is that just theological speculation and those kinds of questions?
Yeah.
And it'll be very helpful to you in that regard. I am constantly surprised after living a lifetime as a Catholic to find out, well, that's not actually a church teaching. That's an idea that the
theological opinion.
Yeah, theological opinion. It's more of a kind of an intertwining river of different ideas and. Then sometimes you would be given the impression it is All Saints Day today.
Cool.
And so this is probably—
So we're out being saints and this is pre-recorded.
We're very busy being saints at this very moment.
Yeah.
I'm polishing my halo. Ryan, though, Jimmy, who is your favorite saint and why?
I don't have a favorite saint, but I can tell you why.
Okay. That's good.
So and the basic reason is I'm not much of one for favorites. It's like if you asked me no, there's a couple of reasons. One is hagiography is not really my area.
Uh-huh.
I spend my time reading, you know, theology, biblical studies, things like that. I don't spend as much time reading biographies of the saints. Mm-hmm. So it's not as much my area. I mean, I obviously know who the famous saints are and I know something about them. But it's asking who's your favorite saint sounds a little bit to me like asking of all the living people in your life that you personally know, who's your favorite person?
It's me, right?
Well, so I was going to say that I prefer not to play favorites.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
I don't have a favorite person. I like lots of people. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a favorite kind of music. I don't have a favorite novel. I don't have a favorite movie. I don't have, favorites in many areas because there's just so much goodness out there in God's world. And I don't even know how to – different things are good in different ways, even in the same category. Some novels have one set of great features. Other novels have another set of great features and it's hard for me. I just want to experience all that good diversity and not spend my time so much trying to say, well, which is the one?
Yeah.
For me, it's why have just one?
Fair enough.
I was thinking about this before the show. When I was a kid, I had a favorite color. I don't think I really do anymore, but it was kind of customary when you were a kid to have a favorite color.
Yeah, what's your favorite color? That's like your main line.
And mine was green.
Really?
But I don't know that that's the case anymore. I do have a favorite pope from my lifetime. That would be Benedict XVI.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a favorite superhero team. That would be the Legion of Superheroes. Mm-hmm. However, even within the team, I don't have a favorite member. So I'm not that big on favorites. Anyone that's got good qualities, I like those good qualities. I like that person.
I think it's healthy too for your other friends to think that they could, possibly be your favorite too. And it would hurt them if they knew that it was me.
Well,
Jimmy.
Never learn the truth from me.
Let's just keep it.
Again, quote the Mikado. Only that's Nanky Poo.
All right. Fair enough. Darren asks, would a human clone have a real human soul? If viable, would genetically modified humans, say crossed with some animal's DNA, have a real human soul?
So the answer to the first question is yes. If it's a living human clone, it's going to have a soul because every living thing has a soul. That's the life principle. That is why it's alive. And if it's a human that's living, then it's going to have a human soul. And in fact, there are many human clones that have human souls, and that the church has always recognized as having human souls. In fact, we had one of them who is – we have one. He used to work here, and now he's a frequent guest on Catholic Answers Live.
Is it Jim Blackburn?
It's Jim Blackburn because he is an identical twin. He has an identical twin brother. That means he and his brother are genetically identical, and therefore at an early stage in their gestation, there was originally one embryo that split into two and thus twigged off. The word twig in Greek is klon, from which we get cloning.
Oh.
And so actually we have had human clones naturally for as long as there have been humans. And in fact, Jesus, although it's not 100% sure he was an identical clone, an identical twin, Jesus had a clone among the 12 disciples, it looks like, because Thomas or Didymus – that name in Aramaic and Greek means the twin.
Oh, you confused me. I thought that you meant Jesus had a clone of himself.
Not of himself.
Confused there. I was like, wait, what?
No. But Thomas, probably he had a different birth name, but because he was known as being a twin, and given that, it would most likely be an identical twin. You wouldn't be as well known if you had a fraternal twin.
Yeah, right.
If it was some probability, it was likely an identical twin. And so he just got called the twin. And so it looks like Jesus may have had a clone in his own 12 apostles who he obviously was concerned for the souls, salvation of their souls. By the way, if you want to learn more about cloning, this month, November, on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, I have an episode on cloning where we talk about all this in more detail. Also, the second question, what about a clone that has some DNA in common with non-human species?
Yes.
Yeah. Would it have a soul? Well, guess what? And would it have a human soul? Well, if it's a human, yes, it would. And again, there are numerous human clones who have DNA in common with non-human species because all humans have DNA in common with other species. In fact, depending on the estimates, between 95 and 98% of human DNA is material we have in common with chimpanzees. And so all humans have 95% or more of their DNA in common with a non-human species. And therefore, all of the identical twins in the human species have DNA in common with non-human species, and therefore all human clones already do have DNA in common with other species. So if someone came along, snipped a couple of extra genes out of another species and put them in a human, it probably wouldn't be enough to alter their species. They'd still be a human with just a little admixture of other DNA, and so they'd still be a human, they'd still have a human soul. On the other hand, if you took a couple of little genes from a human and put them in a chimpanzee, mm-hmm. it's not going to be enough to turn them into a human. They're going to be a chimpanzee with a little admixture of human DNA, and they're therefore going to have a chimpanzee soul.
So in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, do you uh-huh. contemplate some of
this? This is a podcast I do, by
yeah,
the way,
oh,
for
yeah,
people.
Right.
Yeah.
So the episode on cloning, do you contemplate some of the ethical problems we
yeah,
might be coming
oh,
up
yeah.
with? Because this seems – okay, so yeah, you're right. A couple – say somebody has a genetic disease and you can treat that by taking a couple of little strands of DNA and you mm-hmm. supplant them here. And okay, so now you got a couple of chimpanzee things in there. But it cured the disease, what mm-hmm. I'm just imagining.
Yeah.
But you can also see a point at which – you're doing things far beyond that.
Yep.
And is that ethical?
And that's what I talk about on the podcast.
Okay, I gotta watch that. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. We're all part chimpanzee, huh? Is that what you're saying? No, I don't think
largely.
Well,
we and chimpanzees share 95%+ of our DNA.
Francis asks the following: why did the church decide to stop saying the Archangel Michael prayer after Mass?
Okay, so this was a prayer that was introduced like 1896 by Pope Leo XIII as part of a set of prayers called the Leonine Prayers, or as they were originally called often, the prayers after Mass, because this was a set of prayers. Mass is done,
yep.
but then everybody would stay and say these prayers. And the purpose of them changed over time. Originally, they were said for the peace of the Vatican, because at the time there was all this turmoil in Italy. The papal states had been conquered and Italy was in the process of unification. The status of the Pope as the temporal ruler of Vatican City was under threat and so forth. And so these prayers were originally for the temporal peace of the Holy See. And then that became guaranteed by the Lateran Pact of like 1928. And so by that point, the Pope decided, let's change the purpose of these prayers. A pressing need in their day was the fact that Christians, and including Catholics in Russia, were not allowed to freely practice their faith. And so the prayers after Mass got repurposed for to be for the persecuted Christians in Russia. And then in the 1960s at the Second Vatican Council, the Council Fathers expressed a desire to simplify the Mass and retrieve certain forms of within the liturgy that had fallen out of use, that were older, and also to remove some of the newer forms that had – because if you're going to add something back in, you need to kind of balance that by removing something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted to resource the liturgy with older liturgical forms, which meant removing some of the newer things. And so, prayers that got added after the Mass in the 1890s would be among the newest. And so all of the prayers after Mass, including the prayer to St. Michael, were suppressed in 1965 after the council met. And because it was just part of the liturgical reform, they wanted to bring back some older forms in the liturgy, and that meant removing some of the newer forms and kind of streamlining things.
All right. Thank you very, very much, Francis, for that question. It is an internet open forum with Jimmy Akin this hour. Next hour, our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, will be here. We're going to talk a little bit about the Feast of All Saints and the Feast of All Souls.
You're downgrading it now.
I know. It was a big promise that I made before.
I was looking forward to all the data compression if you're going to talk about all
We're
going
to have to talk so fast if we're going to talk about All Saints. Before we send you off to a quick break here, will you join Radio Club? We'd love it if you join Radio Club. It's just about giving you free stuff. We want to give you free stuff. I've been doing these. Marie, our assistant producer, has been scheduling these little interviews that I do with Jimmy and Carlo and Trent and Tim and some other folks around here. That's all bonus material that you can get. We give you some behind-the-scenes stuff. We ask you questions, a poll question. Not every week, but on many weeks, Ooh. We'll send you out a poll question to help us make decisions about things.
You should, like, as a free bonus for the Radio Club members, you should send them a photo of the secret chairs, what no one gets to see.
We should send them a photo of the secret chairs. Jimmy.
There are some secret chairs in the studio that, even though they were meant to be used, we've never actually used them, and they're not on camera the way the cameras are normally set up, so no one gets to see these.
And they're not particularly functional for any kind of media either.
No, they're really low.
I don't know. All right, we'll do that. We'll put a picture. But the way you join Radio Club, you can send a note to us that you want to join Radio Club to the email address radio@catholic.com, or you can go to CatholicAnswersLive.com and just sign up there. There's a button you press to sign up, and you become a member of Radio Club, and you get free stuff. Send it to radio@catholic.com or go to CatholicAnswersLive.com and sign up there.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Fallen away Catholic years and years ago, doing my own thing. My mom and dad never gave up on me, and I know it was the Holy Rosary. And they kept after me, Philip, pray your rosary. And eventually I did. I'm a member of the Knights of the Immaculata, Maximilian Kolbe's group. I'm with the Legion of Mary, and I haven't stopped leading the rosary in nursing homes, thanks be to God.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A very blessed Feast of All Saints to you and your family. Jimmy Akin's here taking questions from the internet this hour, and we have a question from Eric. Eric asks, at the very end of time, after the general resurrection, will the blessed exclusively be worshiping God for all eternity in a contemplative, passive fashion, or will we, besides enjoying the beatific vision and worshiping God, be conducting life in some way congruent to our earthly lives? For example, will we get to exercise our talents and interests and express our personalities? Might there be some sort of community and even trade?
So we don't have a lot of answers here. The Bible uses various images to convey what heaven's going to be like. But it's hard to say exactly what it's going to be like because it exceeds our present ability to imagine. That's something that we have various statements indicating it hasn't yet been revealed what we're going to be like, but we know we'll be like him because we will see him as he is. So we have to be a little careful here. I tend to like a line From the and also it is presented to us. Heaven is presented to us as a living on a new earth in union with a new heaven. So heaven and earth are no longer separated; they're united together. And there's been a profound renovation in nature of some kind. And consequently, I tend to like a line by the performance artist Laurie Anderson: "Paradise is exactly like where you are right now, only much." Much better. And that's pretty consistent, actually, with the way the Bible presents it. It's going to continue to be a physical existence, a bodily existence, but in an upgraded way, in spiritual union with God. And the indications we're given – now, since God gave us personalities, it's only to be expected those are going to continue in the future. I mean, he wouldn't bother making us all distinct and giving us each different gifts and different talents and things like that if he didn't mean for those to be something that he valued and that we should expect to continue. We see Jesus continuing to have his personality and even distinctive things about him, like where he can manifest the nail marks and so forth if he chooses. That he experienced on the cross. So, and he was, you know, recognizable. He could also change his appearance, so he wasn't limited to just looking one way, but he could look like him, like who he was. So he still retained personal distinctiveness. In terms of ongoing activity, the portrait, although we do have passages that portray us and the angels worshiping God, we also have passages indicating that there's more to it than that. We're told, for example, that we're going to judge angels at one point. Now, you could say, well, that all happens on Judgment Day. We do all the judging and then we get that over with. But we're also told we're going to reign with Christ forever, and that reigning activity suggests more than just passive contemplation and worship of God. So, so who knows? It's hard to say. Sometimes, you know, when we field questions on our Weird Questions Day, people ask about could there be planets that are not fallen that we could one day meet their inhabitants and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, maybe one day we will be a post-fallen planet, and people will be coming to meet us.
And how lucky they'll be, because we'll really be at our best by then.
We'll have improved things by then. Yeah. Gotten over the embarrassing stuff.
Yeah, the embarrassing stuff will be over. The awkward period.
The planetary embarrassment.
Yes. Judy asks this, Jimmy, since the Holy Eucharist is the summit of our faith, how come it is not directly mentioned in the Apostles' Creed?
Well, you can argue that it is, because Jesus is prominently mentioned in the Apostles' Creed. In fact, there are more clauses in the Apostles' Creed than there are for either of the other two persons of the Trinity or for other matters. And so, so that's – you could say, well, the Eucharist is. He's just not mentioned under the guise of the Eucharist. The Eucharist is the way we experience Jesus in this life, these days, because he's gone to heaven. But the Creed is about the fundamentals of our faith, which involves remembering the basis that Jesus laid for it in his earthly ministry and what happened in his life, death, and resurrection. And so those are the articles that the Creed focuses on. And consequently, it doesn't feel the need to mention him appearing for us in the guise of the Eucharist, because it's already spent most of the Creed discussing him already.
All right, Judy, thank you for that one. Brent, Jimmy asks, why does God not allow individuals the ability to firsthand verify supernatural claims?
Well, most individuals don't have the ability to do a rigorous investigation and verification of supernatural things. Some individuals do. There are times, when people – and we see this in the Bible, for example, when someone may pray to God about a miracle and it may happen. And the same thing can happen today. People may have a loved one, let's say, who's got some horrible disease, and they pray for the person's recovery, and then they may miraculously recover in a way that can't be explained by modern medical science or our understanding of how the human body works. There are cases of medical miracles today. There are other miracles too. So some individuals are lucky enough to have that happen in their lives. However, it's not the norm. And there are a number of ways of approaching the question of why isn't it the norm. Basically, it's a subcase of the problem of evil. Why does God allow evil? In this case, the evil is an intellectual one, not having the confirmation one would want.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
And so the standard, and I've got a whole, you know, DVD on the problem of evil I'd recommend for that. And I obviously can't go through all that right now. But basically, I would say a couple of things. God will not hold you accountable for what you don't have. And so if someone is innocently ignorant of the truths of the faith because they didn't have the confirmation that would have led them to embrace the faith, well, as long as they're not at fault for that, then they're not going to be held accountable for what they didn't know through no fault of their own. The second thing is, so God's ultimately being fair and even generous with everybody, because with many people, he does give them the ability, at least at some point in their lives, to experience the supernatural in a way that can't be explained away. But then even for people who don't have that, he's willing to provide evidence for you of some form or another. So you may not need to see, for example, Jesus rise from the dead yourself if you have a nice apologetics book by Jimmy Akin that says, here's the case for Jesus raising from the dead, mm-hmm. and it lays out the evidence. You don't necessarily need to have seen it yourself as long as you do somehow get evidence to support the existence of the supernatural. And then, of course, there's the elephant in the universe, which is the universe itself.
Oh.
How did the universe get here? Why is there something rather than nothing? Even if you say, well, our universe came from a previous one or something like that, okay, that doesn't answer the question.
Yeah.
That's just talking about how far the history of the world goes back, not why is there something rather than nothing. And ultimately, there needs to be an explanation for why the natural world exists. And that explanation, if it's going to explain the natural world, it must transcend the natural world. And therefore, there would need to be something beyond mere nature to explain the existence of nature. And whatever is beyond nature, by definition, is supernatural. So just the mere fact that we live in the natural world points to the existence of something upon which the natural world's existence depends.
Brent, thank you very, very much for that question. Let's go to Kathleen, who asks this. How can one always remain humble when the Lord has helped you to gain knowledge by giving you great interest?
I have no insight on this.
I have not a clue. I'm so glad. Let's just end the show right there with Jimmy saying, I have not.
If I did, I would say that that heeding the axiom, know thyself, will help. Because if everybody has flaws, everybody has limitations, and reminding yourself of your own limitations and your own weaknesses and the things that you need to work on that you don't like about yourself, having an awareness of all of these things will help you stay humble regardless of whatever benefits you have, whether it's a gift you've been given of curiosity that leads you to having a lot of knowledge, whether it's a gift of physical vigor that leads you to having a really, you know, ripped set of abs or whatever. Whatever good points you have that are things you should appreciate and thank God for and give yourself credit for cultivating and developing, all of those things are good. But the key to humility is taking a peek periodically at the other side of things, at the parts of you that are not what they should be, and being willing to face those and acknowledge those. And that's the key to – that's one of the keys to humility. The other is empathy, looking at other people and appreciating both their good qualities and the things that they struggle with and thinking, I'm the same. I have weak points too. It may not be the same as theirs, but I can sympathize with them in their weakness because I have to live with me and my weakness.
Kathleen, thank you for your question. Thanks to everybody who sends us questions so we can have these internet open forums. We appreciate it. Jimmy Akin, thank you for a very fine hour.
My pleasure, Si.
And people can already pre-order the book, right? If they
want to
get Teaching with Authority.
Both at Amazon and at Catholic.com.
Okay. And I highly recommend you do it. Next hour, Father will be here. Our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, will be here. We're going to discuss these twin feasts, the Feast of All Saints and the Feast of All Souls, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.